This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 99-year-old Vic Freudenberger of San Luis Obispo, California, originally from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He enlisted in the Marine Corps in 1938 and spent some time aboard the cruiser USS Wichita before volunteering for paratrooper duty. The Marines had never had paratroopers before, and he became one of the first. Now, to his knowledge, he's the last member of that first parachute battalion still living. After all that airborne training, Vic's first taste of combat came in a battle where he had to head in on a Higgins boat, leading his squad in the initial landing on Gavutu as part of the Battle of Guadalcanal in August 1942. The boat got hung up and couldn't make it all the way to shore, and his assistant squad leader was killed before Vic even made it in. A couple hours later, a mortar shell landed between Vic and a fellow Marine.
I was hit in the leg, and one large piece of fragment was about an inch long, and it lodged directly into my heel, into the bone. And it was actually large enough, it was protruding out from the heel of my boot. And so the corpsman, of course, took the boot off, but and we tried to move the fragment, but it was lodged in the bone. And so naturally it was pretty painful. What they always do, they give you a shot and morphine, and then they also give you a shot of, I'll try to remember.
Penicillin or something?
Tetanus shot.
Tetanus stuff
tetanus,
for the metal.
Yes.
Yeah. But you can't walk, obviously.
I couldn't walk on it, no. It was very painful. So I, with assistance and the corpsman, got me down to the beach where the wounded were waiting to be evacuated. Later in the afternoon, we were put aboard an APA. We, of course, were all in cots below decks. And the next day, the Japanese came in with about 20 bombers, and we could hear the bombing going on, and we knew that they were trying to get the ships. And fortunately, the Navy was prepared and shot practically all of them down. But then the second night, the Japanese Navy came in and completely surprised the U.S. Navy. Three cruisers were sunk, three American cruisers and one Australian cruiser. So the Navy was completely devastated by that. The Admiral decided he had to leave because there were only three aircraft carriers in the whole Pacific at that time. And so he decided to leave, and that was before half of the equipment and the ammunition and food had been unloaded. So when they left the division there completely on their own. No aircraft were supporting them. And ammunition and food were, half of them were still aboard the Navy ships. And so they were completely at their mercy. So it took about 2 weeks before support aircraft came in. In the meantime, they were receiving fire. Submarines would come up and fire directly at them in the daytime. And at night, the cruisers and all would come in and bomb. And oh, they'd receive bombing from the daytime. And also at night, they'd receive firing from the ships. So they were under fire practically the whole time.
So the reality for you was...
I was fortunate enough that I'd been wounded.
Yeah, you were a lot better off where you were than had you still been on Guadalcanal.
So I was very fortunate in that respect. And so I went back to had a newly formed Naval Hospital, Mobile Hospital, they called. So we were the first patients that they had. As I said, when we were coming over from the States to New Zealand, we were given two shots for tetanus shot.
Yeah.
So we received two tetanus shots. When I was wounded, I was given another one, which was okay, that was three. When I got aboard the APA, the next day, they gave me another shot, and trying to tell them that I already had three, but they said, well, no record of it. So I received a fourth shot. And then about a week later, we were transferred to a hospital ship. And when I got on the hospital ship, the doctor was giving me another. And I tried to explain to him, and I'd received four shots. Still did not believe me. So I received a fifth shot. And at that point, my friends who were with other wounded said I blew up. I became unconscious, and I blew up like a balloon. They said they were afraid I was going to die, and so I was fortunate that I survived that. I had received 5 shots when 2 or 3 were adequate.
Well, and so, you mentioned going back to this newly formed mobile hospital. What did they have to do for you? What could they do for that fragment in your heel?
Well, they did attempt to. The days after I got there, after I got over the, it was 3 or 4 days, I guess, before I survived from the tetanus shot.
Oh, so that was before they could ever operate on your foot?
Before they operated on me.
Uh-huh.
And so the first operation, after that, they said, well, we're sorry, we couldn't get it out. I said, couldn't get it out? No, it's really lodged in your bone. He said, you may never walk on that foot again. I said, please, try again. So the second operation, they did remove it. I kept it as a souvenir. I lost it many years ago, but it was at least 1 inch long. It was a fairly large piece. And it was a long time that I was still limping on my foot, but I was able to walk. And that was another fortunate that they were able to get it removed, of course.
Well, and I'm always curious. You know, I've talked to guys who were at Pearl Harbor on the 7th and wounded there right at the start of the war before they ever had a chance to fight.
Right.
And your experience wasn't that different. Here you've done all this training, 3 years of training, 4 years of training almost by the time you get to Guadalcanal.
Right.
A few hours of combat, and you're out of commission.
That's right, yeah.
So what was your mindset after that? Did that discourage you and make you not want to go back, or was it the opposite end of the spectrum?
Well, obviously, I knew we were going to continue. So after I left, the parachute battalion joined the Raiders, and the Raiders and the paratroopers had a battle in September, which was a critical battle. It's called Bloody Ridge or Essence Ridge. About 500 men, and together the two battalions held off a regiment for 1 whole night. The book of the chosen, it's in a book if you want the details of that. Of course, I wasn't there, but...
Right, but this book, for people who are hearing some of this and want to see the big picture,
right,
it's called Battalion of the Damned by James Crist, and it tells the story of the 1st Marine Paratroopers at Gavutu and Bloody Ridge, what you're talking about there in September
right.
of 42.
At the end of the Bloody Ridge in September, there were only about 60 of the battalions still physically able to, either wounded or killed. They were evacuated to... transferred to French Island, Noumea, New Caledonia. So by that time, after I was in the hospital about 6 weeks and then transferred with some of the others to, we were placed in the island of New Caledonia, had an army division there, and right in Noumea. But they sent us out into the, about 10 miles out of town, to an old base that evidently had been occupied by other troops. The first few nights that we were in the tents, we all were just covered with fleas. It was so bad.
Oof.
That they decided that they burned the whole thing down completely, the tents and the whole thing. So they were so bad. And so anyway, there we are, and yeah, waiting for replacements. Well, there were no replacements coming. The only good part was that we were right by a river, so we could wash and bathe and wash our clothes. I was there about, 8 weeks. Orders came that there were to be 20 of the senior enlisted would become second lieutenants, and 20 would be sent back to the New River, where they now had the school set up, a large school, a parachute school. And so fortunately, I was one of them selected, and so I was, being a sergeant, I was sent back with a close friend of mine. The two of us went back to New River, North Carolina. We're instructors there for about 3-4 months, and that's when the commandant decided that there was no reason to keep the paratroopers any longer, because landing on small islands, which was already established, is what's going to happen. He disbanded the paratroopers and also the Raider Battalion. They formed the 3rd Division. They were already in the 2nd Division and then the 3rd. And so at that point, I knew if I'd stay there, I'd be in the division. So I requested that to be transferred into ordnance, because I had received training as a demolition technician, and that kind of appealed to me. So I was transferred to ordnance school in Quantico, Virginia. I had 30-day leave. I was in Philadelphia. I met my wife, or wife-to-be. And
how did that happen? Tell me the story.
Well, we were another sergeant. He convinced me to go on to a dance on Saturday night. It was right in Philadelphia downtown by the city hall. So I went along with him, even though I wasn't big on dancing. But it so happened that I, near the end of the dance, I saw the beautiful young lady, who was just a beautiful person, in my opinion, and very tanned. And so I looked at my friend and I said, I'm going to marry that gal. So before I even met her. So, of course, I introduced myself. And so 4 months later, we were married. And the reason that happened so quickly was that I convinced her that I would have 4 months of school. And then I expected to be sent overseas again, logically. So she surprisingly said yes. And it turned out that we were married for 73 years. Very, very fortunate and just a perfect marriage. And fortunately, she enjoyed the service. And that's why I stayed in at the end of World War II.
Yeah, you stayed in for 22 years in the Marine Corps. But World War II still has some time left. So
yeah.
You get married.
So got married. And at the end of my school, I was retained as an instructor, and that was fortunate. So I was instructing demolitions, and in October of 44, I was appointed warrant officer, which was quite unusual because I was only in for 6 years, and I was only 24. But anyway, that meant, of course, I was going to be going overseas, but I had to get another 6 weeks or 2 months of training as an ordnance officer. Transferred out to the West Coast, to Camp Pendleton. What they do, they have drafts. The train load had a draft of about 2,500 men from the East Coast. We actually were down in San Diego and ready to go aboard the ships when they pulled us back and sent another draft in place of us. Why, we didn't know, but it was fact that it was, again, we were fortunate. It turned out that, remember, this was in December of 44. The Iwo Jima was February. And so that was, that first draft was the first replacement to go into Iwo Jima. And so I missed Iwo Jima by that, again, fortune. And out of the original battalion who stayed in and became part of the 3rd Division, out of the original 400, there were 96 killed in Iwo Jima from the original battalion.
Wow.
So I was very fortunate again. It seemed like God was taking care of me.
Yeah, there's a pattern developing here.
It really was, yes. And I immediately checked to find out how long it would be in at Pendleton before we shipped out again. And they said, you'd probably be here 3 months. So I immediately called my wife, and she was on the train at the same day, and she came out, and I was stationed in what they call Tent Camp 3, which is up north near San Clemente.
Mm-hmm.
So while she's on her way, I was able to fortunately find an apartment right in San Clemente on the ocean, a beautiful home. The way I found it, I checked at a couple of realtors, and they all laughed and said, there's nothing available. There was a motel right on the coast, so that's where I was checking. It so happened as I was walking in the motel, this lieutenant came out from the adjoining home and had a suitcase in his hand. I said, are you leaving? He said, yeah, but you better hurry up because Miss Wirk is going to be driving on the coast to make the apartment available. And so I had to run around. It was on around the corner of the street. And she was actually in the car, and I ran in front of her and said, I'll take it. So again, how lucky can you get? So there's my wife. For 6 weeks, she was able to go swimming every day in January,
yeah.
In February.
Can't do that in Philadelphia.
From Philadelphia. So again, we enjoyed that sojourn. And so then in March, we left and went to Guam. There were no vacancies for the ammunition company, so I was assigned as an ordnance officer for a 155 gun, which is the long tom, the heavy, long rifle. I was the ordnance officer of that. So we were preparing to land. The invasion of Japan was to be October of 45. So we were, of course, training for that. So the fact that an atomic bomb was dropped instead of us going in, the estimated casualties for the first 30 days was to be 1 million casualties, because the Japanese had several hundred kamikaze planes. As you probably know, the kamikaze plane was one way they would crash into the most target they could find. And if they'd hit a ship, they could kill hundreds. And so, again, very fortunate that the two bombs caused the end of the war.
But that did not mean his combat experience was over. Vic would end up 5 years later in one of the Korean War's most legendary battles. Vic Freudenberger turns 100 years old at the end of January. They're planning quite a celebration for him at Las Brisas in San Luis Obispo. Thanks, by the way, to Julie Tacker from Las Brisas for letting us know about Vic's story. Check out the photos of Vic then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.